God will always do what he says. That's true at all times. It's true in all cases. And it's especially true when it comes to Genesis 3:15. Chapters 4 and 5, which is what we're going to look at mainly today, really all of Genesis and the entire Old Testament are meant to show us that God will do what he says in Genesis 3, verse 15. And what God says in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, is that the seed of a woman, the offspring of a woman, a child born from woman, is going to come and crush the serpent's head. That's what God says. That's what Genesis 3:15 is about. And that's the main thing that we need to see and settle on before we get into these next chapters in Genesis. And the reason why is because from here out, it's going to get really complex in Genesis. And I don't mean complex in terms of like it's going to be a negative thing. I mean it's going to be complex in terms of there are layers upon layers of all kinds of things that have so many different kinds of implications for us, and I just don't want us to get lost, okay? So, Genesis 3:15 is sort of like our compass that's going to help us navigate through what's to come here in the book of Genesis. So, let's do this. Let's look again closely just for a moment at Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, and then we'll get into chapters 4 and 5. So, Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, all right? This is after Adam and Eve have fallen into sin. God comes, and he speaks to them, and he speaks to the serpent, and he is pronouncing a curse because of sin. And he's talking to the serpent here in verse 15. This is what God says in Genesis 3:15. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring, he shall bruise your head. So the offspring of woman shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. Now, I want to just point something out you may be asking, you may be wondering about, because I've used the phrase in this sermon, Pastor Joe used it last week, but we've said that this verse, Genesis 3:15, is about the serpent crusher, right? This is a verse it's a prophecy about the offspring of woman who will one day come and crush the head of the serpent. But when we read in a lot of our English Bibles, it says bruise, not crush. Anyone seen that? Anyone noticed that? Is this room right? Okay, good. Most translations, the English Standard Version, the translation that I prefer, it says bruise, not crush, and bruise and crush are different, right? Would you rather get bruised on your head or your head crushed? You know, these are different words here. So, what's the deal? Why? What is meant to? What's going on here? Well, the Hebrew word that's used here in Genesis 3:15 is only used two other times in the entire Old Testament, and in those places, Job 9:17, Psalm 139:11, the word is translated to crush and to overcome. And crush and overcome have similar meanings, and the way you figure out which way to translate it is always determined by the context around where the word is used. That's how it always goes with translation, right? You have a range of meaning, and then the context determines how you translate the word. And if you look at Genesis 3:15, the context here, I think saying crush is a fine word to use. I like that word. I prefer that. But it only works as long as we don't miss what else is being said here, okay? The stress in Genesis 3:15 is the ongoing conflict between the offspring of the serpent and the offspring of the woman. God starts Genesis 3:15 with saying that there's going to be enmity between the serpent and the woman. The kids and I, we just learned this word last night. We were talking about it. What does enmity mean? It means hostility, violence, okay? There's going to be conflict, hostility between the serpent and the woman. And then God says that this hostility is going to be passed on to future generations, which means this is not going to be a one-time battle. This is going to be an ongoing war between the offspring of the serpent and the offspring of the woman. And I think that's the idea behind saying bruise. The idea behind saying bruise is that there's going to be a volley of punches, okay? back and forth, back and forth. There's a volley of punches from one side to the other, from that side back to that side, and it's going to last over the long haul. This is not a one-time thing. Some translations actually use the English word strike. I think that makes good sense. Strike. The NIV, I think, does that. Strike. The image there is that both the offspring of the serpent and the offspring of the woman are trading hits back and forth. They're trading strikes back and forth. And the difference comes in that the offspring of the woman takes it on the heel, but the offspring of the serpent gets it on the head. And the implication there is that the strike on the head is eventually going to be decisive and fatal, which means there is going to be a real skull crushing. The serpent will be crushed. And the image, it actually goes more like this. Instead of punches like this, the image is actually more like this. See? It's like stomp, 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 and eventually, boom, crush. The serpent's head will be crushed. Satan will be destroyed. This is the way Christians have read this verse since the second century. And more importantly, this is the way the Apostle Paul applies this verse in Romans 16. There is going to be an ultimate head-stomping, dragon-slaying victory by the woman's offspring. But it's not going to happen right away, and it's not going to happen without a fight. And that's the main thing we need to know before we keep reading in Genesis or in the Old Testament as a whole. So before we get into Genesis chapter 4 and 5, let me just state again the main message of Genesis 3:15, okay? This is Genesis 3:15. This is what we need to see and settle on. It's this. God will ensure that the dragon slayer, head stomper, serpent crusher will come. God will ensure that he comes, but he will come with a war waged against him. And we're going to start seeing that war today in our passage. So with that, let's look at Genesis 4 and 5. And we're going to look at these two chapters in three parts. Okay, really simple. Cain, Seth, Noah. So 3 points, or really three names, three people. Cain, Seth, and then Noah. We're going to start with Cain, Genesis 4, chapter 4, verse 1. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. Now the whole purpose of Cain, I think, in this story is to say that he is not the serpent-crushing offspring of the woman that's mentioned in Genesis 3:15. Now he could have been, we have to know that, Cain could have been the offspring of a woman promised in Genesis 3:15, but he's not the one. And in fact, I think chapter 4 goes on to show us that Cain actually becomes the symbol of the anti-Genesis 3:15. Cain becomes the ultimate anti-offspring. He's the anti-son. Let me give you two reasons why that's the case, okay? This is why Cain is the anti-offspring, all right? Cain, number one, is too much like Adam and worse. You may have noticed, if you read through this before, that the whole scenario of Cain and his sin and his response is eerily similar to Adam's. First, let me give you the background, okay? Cain has a younger brother named Abel, and the two brothers, the text says, in the course of time, they're worshiping God. Cain's a farmer, and so he brings an offering to God from his crop. Abel's a shepherd, and so he brings an offering to God from his flock. And then verses 4 and 5 say that God accepted Abel's offering, but not Cain's. And this made Cain very angry. And so God comes to talk to Cain about that. All right? Could you imagine that? Imagine that when you get angry, God comes to talk to you about it. He comes and starts asking you questions about why you feel the way you feel. That's what he does here with Cain. He comes and he's asking Cain why he's angry. And then he exhorts him. Verse 7, he says to Cain, God speaking to Cain, if you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. Now notice this in verse 7, how God personifies sin. Sin is crouching at the door. Sounds like an animal, right? Sin almost sounds like a serpent. Like it's crouching. It's coiled up at the doorway. And God says, its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. He's saying, sin, Cain, sin wants to make you dragon food. But you got to resist it, Cain. That's what he's saying. The message is clear. God is saying to Cain, watch out. In the next verse, Genesis 3, verse 8, Cain spoke to Abel, his brother. And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Very next verse. So Cain sinned. He's guilty. The sin that was crouching at his door has devoured him. And just like God did with Adam, he comes to Cain with questions. First, in verse 9, God says, now, where is Abel, your brother? And, you know, God first asked Adam, where are you? And Adam replied to God that he was afraid, so he was hiding. But look at what Cain says. God says, hey, Cain, where is Abel, your brother? And Cain says, I do not know. Liar. He knows where he's at. He's lying here to God. And then Cain, he even turns the question back on God. He questions God's question. He says, am I my brother's keeper? There's a little wordplay here. Abel was a keeper of sheep. That's what verse 2 says. And so what Cain's got a smart mouth here with God. Cain is saying to God, am I the keeper's keeper? Am I the shepherd's shepherd? That's what Cain says to God. And God knows what's going on. You know, he knows the answer to these questions. He asks these questions. He knows. God says, the innocent blood of Abel is crying up from the ground, condemning Cain. And so God curses Cain. Cain is exiled to wander. He becomes a vagabond. He's sent out east of Eden, chapter 4, verse 16, just like Adam was sent out east of Eden, chapter 3, verse 24. And just like God clothed Adam with fig leaves by mercy, God puts a mark on Cain by mercy to spare his life, which is a little strange. I'll tell you what I think it means a little bit later. So Cain is a lot like Adam. He sins. He's questioned by God. He's exiled east of Eden. He's marked by God. But Cain is worse than Adam. Cain was warned about his sin, and he did it anyway. Cain doesn't squirm and blame shift when God questions him. Cain outright lies, and then he questions the premise of God's own question. And worst of all, of course, is the most obvious. Cain killed his brother. Cain kills the offspring of woman. He wipes out the offspring of woman in a murderous rage. So Cain becomes the anti-offspring. He's the anti-son. And there's another way we see this, I think, in verse 1, chapter 4, verse 1. It's this. Eve tried to do herself what God said he would do. Let me show you this, what Eve says in verse 1. Eve says, after Cain is born, she says, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. But there's a question here about, is what she's saying positive or negative? Okay, the word help in our English translations is added. She actually just says, I have gotten a man with the Lord, or beside the Lord. And the word forgotten means to create or to produce or acquire. So another way to translate chapter 4, verse 1 is that she's saying, I have created a man with the Lord. And the idea is that Eve's actually saying, I have created a man just like the Lord did. I think Eve, in verse 1, is saying that she can take this offspring thing into her own hands. I think Eve is saying that she can do what God said he would do. God said he's going to send an offspring to crush the serpent, and Eve is saying, you got to imagine, this is the first kid ever born in the history of the world. I've seen childbirth. It's an amazing thing, all right? I've seen it 5 times. It blows your mind, right? This is the first kid ever born. Eve sees this and she says, hey, I can do this. I can do this offspring thing. I can create just like God. This is a negative statement. I think it makes more sense when we see it in contrast to the birth of Seth in chapter 4, verse 25. All right, so look down at chapter 4, verse 25. Seth is Eve's third son, okay? And when Seth is born, this is what Eve says. She says, God has appointed for me another offspring instead of Abel, for Cain killed him. So she's saying very different things when Cain is born than when Seth is born, all right? When Cain is born, she says, I have gotten, or I have created. And it's the Hebrew word kana, which is where the name Cain comes from, right? But then when Seth is born, she says, God has appointed. And it's the Hebrew word sheth, appoint, which is where the name Seth comes from, right? So with Cain, it's I have gotten created, Cain. And with Seth, it's God has appointed Seth. See? Cain, create. Seth, appointed. One is I have gotten. The other is God has given. I think that's what we're supposed to see here. It's I have gotten versus God has given. I think Eve in verse 1 foreshadows another woman who we'll see later in the book of Genesis who also tries to take into her own hands what God said he would do. Later in Genesis chapter 16, God told Abram and Sarah that he'd give them a son, remember? But what does Sarah do? She takes things into her own hands with her servant Hagar, who she makes her surrogate to give birth to a son named Ishmael. And it's the same thing. Eve in chapter 4, verse 1, and Sarah in chapter 16, they're doing the same thing. It's this theme that we start to see in the Bible. I have gotten versus God has given. It's the spirit of Babel versus the spirit of faith. And just like this sort of thing could have happened back then, and it did, it can happen today, and it could even happen in our church. This I have gotten versus God has given. So this is a little time out here for a second. This is a little personal application for City's Church. We're a baby church, all right? And what that means, being a young church, we're not even 2 years old yet, it means a couple things for us, okay? For one, because we're so new, it means that we have a lot of room to grow. I mean, there are all kinds of ways all kinds of room for growth, and most, you know, foremost in that is we want to be more effective at our mission to make disciples and be more effective in making Jesus known and seeking the good of the cities. There's a lot of room for growth, okay? The second thing is that because we're not even 2 years old yet, a lot of us can think back to a time when none of this existed. Because it wasn't long ago, right? We're just not even 2 years old. So it wasn't long ago when there was no such thing as City's Church. And yet, look, we're here today, right? We're you and me, like this thing is happening. Like we're doing it right now. This thing is happening. The church is here. God has done this. And some of you have been here since the very beginning. Some of you were part of this thing and it was just a pipe dream in a living room, right? And others of you have, and many of you have been here since the very start. And you've seen this happen. And God forbid that we would ever think about City's Church and say, I have gotten instead of God has given. We are, as followers of Jesus, we're called and commissioned to be active, right? Active, amen? We're called to be active. We're called to live on mission. But never, let us never think that we can take any of this, into our own hands. God has given. God has given. That's the chorus. Over and over and over again, God has given, God has given, God gives, God will give. All glory be to Christ. That is how we do it here, okay? That is our song, that is our hope, is that God has given, not I've gotten. And there are so many applications for this. Just think, your jobs, your family, your children, there are so many applications for this. It is not I have gotten. It's always God has given. God has given, all right? All right, close that. Back to Genesis 4. Cain's not the offspring of Genesis 3:15. He's the anti-offspring, and I think we see this decisively in 4:25, in the fact that Seth is born, okay? So we've done Cain here, a little bit of a side note there. Now we're here talking about Seth. So we move from Cain, now we're talking about Seth. Second point, when Seth is born in 4:25, Eve calls him offspring. That's the exact same word used in Genesis 3:15. And there's supposed to be no doubt here that Eve sees the connection. Seth is the offspring line flowing from Genesis 3:15. Eve is trying to do that. She sees that. Seth, offspring, God has appointed me an offspring. She makes a connection. Genesis 3:15. That's who Seth is. But my question is, why? Why is it Seth instead of Cain? Why is Seth the offspring instead of Cain? We might think it's because Cain's a bad guy. You know, he's sinful. He killed Abel. You know, he's ungodly. And that's true. The New Testament makes his point. 1 John 3, Jude 11, Cain becomes a figure of sin. He's a bad guy. But I don't think that's the reason why God chooses Seth instead of Cain. Okay, remember I mentioned earlier the mark that God put on Cain to spare his life. Well, I think the mark that God put on Cain to spare his life is meant to show us that his sin, Cain's sin, is not the decisive factor in what makes him the anti-offspring. Instead, the decisive factor is God's election. God chose Seth instead of Cain. God could have chosen Cain, right? Flawed men, if you read the Bible, you see flawed men are not a problem for God. Right? He could have chosen Cain. And in fact, Cain is the older brother. Cain has sons. He's even got great-great-grandsons. And they've built a civilization. They have a city. They have a culture. They are incredibly advanced. And God could have said, all right, my offspring is going to come from Cain and his line. There's my offspring. But instead, God starts all over with a baby. God chooses not the oldest brother with all of his advantages, but he chooses the youngest brother. He chooses a baby with all of his disadvantages. Get the contrast here. We're looking at with Cain, we're looking at a whole civilization here. They got music, they got medals, they got all kinds of stuff. That's what I think chapter 4 is saying about Cain. You have an advanced civilization with Cain. And then you got a little baby who needs a diaper change. And God chooses the baby. He chooses the baby over a whole civilization. And God does it that way because that's the way God does it. What happens here at the end of chapter 4, a theme gets kicked off that we see throughout the entire Old Testament, leading up to and even in the Gospel of Matthew. It's a theme that we could call the drama of the Son. This is thread. It runs all the way through the entire Bible, this drama of the Son. And it goes like this, all right? We know God's going to send an offspring. He's going to send a son to destroy Satan. And we know, therefore, Satan hates the Son. And so we're asking, suspensefully, where is the Son? When will the Son get here? How is Satan going to fight against him? What is God going to do? And we see this drama unfold little by little, and it has two basic pieces. Number one, the Son is always unexpected. And number two, the Son is always under attack. And we can see easily this unexpectation theme. It shows up over and over again. And it shows up primarily, I think, in the theme of always one brother being chosen when it could have been, should have been, another. It's Seth, not Cain. It's Shem, not Ham or Japheth. It's Abram not Nahor or Haran. It's Isaac, not Ishmael. It's Jacob, not Esau. It's Judah, not his 11 other brothers. It's David, not his 7 other brothers, all stronger and older than him. God chooses the youngest. I think the story of David captures the thing perfectly. King David in 1 Samuel 16. The prophet Samuel, he comes to Jesse, who's David's father, because God has told Samuel that one of Jesse's sons is going to be anointed king over Israel. And so Samuel comes and he's looking at every single one of these potential kings that are Jesse's sons, and it's none of them. God says, no, it's not this one, not this one, not this one. And so Samuel's confused, and he says to Jesse, are these all your sons? And Jesse says, yeah, oh, well, we got one more. He's a little guy out keeping sheep. That's the Hebrew word, seriously, is little guy. It's katon. It means like he's like the runt. He's like the little dweeb. That's what the word is. Is this all your sons? And Jesse's like, we got the little guy out keeping sheep. And Samuel says, bring him to me. And as soon as he sees David, the Spirit of God rushes upon him. And David is the one. Again, God again, over and over and over again. Not what we would expect. The son is always unexpected and always under attack. We're not even out of the book of Genesis, barely, until Pharaoh tells all the Egyptians to kill every Hebrew boy that's going to be born. Kill all the male children. He wants to kill them all, right? This is Satan trying to wipe out the offspring of woman in a murderous rage. Just kill them all. And then you got Israel's kingship. There's unbelievable turmoil when it comes through the sons. David's own son conspires against him. And then all of the sons after him fail to live up to their calling. Most of them are bad kings who forsake God. And in their worst days, the people of Israel actually sacrifice their sons to false gods. Israel has a history of sons under attack, sons fighting one another, sons being murdered. And that is what Seth is stepping into in Genesis 4. He's stepping into a war. He's stepping into a world of hostility between his line and the serpent. And then we hear about Noah in Genesis 5. This is our last point. Cain, Seth, Noah. Look at chapter 5, verse 28 and 29 about Noah. Remember this drama, right? The drama of the son. The question is, when will this son come? When will he come? Verse 28. When Lamech had lived 182 years, he fathered a son and called his name Noah. The name Noah means rest or relief. We've got Noah. We named our fifth Noah. Yeah, I did. His brothers and sisters love it. They called his name Noah, right? Look at this. They called his name Noah, saying, out of the ground that the Lord has cursed, this one shall bring us relief from all our work and from the painful toil of our hands. There's no doubt here who they hope Noah is, right? You see what his dad says? His dad says, finally, we have a son who has come to save us from the curse of sin. Finally, we have a son who will give us rest. They think Noah is the one. They think Noah is the serpent crusher from Genesis 3:15. And the story here just kind of lets it hang there for a while. Maybe Noah is the serpent crusher. Maybe he is. Well, we're going to see in the next 2 weeks, and this is a spoiler alert, okay? Noah's not the guy, all right? He's not the one. But there is one. The true serpent crusher, the true son, he's going to come later. And like all the sons before him, he's going to come unexpected and under attack. He's going to come so unexpected, so different from what you think, that he's going to be born in a barn. His parents are going to be under the rule of a foreign king, and they're going to be traveling to a little podunk town called Bethlehem, and his mother is going to start having contractions while they're on the road. And of all nights, all the motel rooms are going to be full, so they're going to have to find a stable. And in that stable with the cows and the chickens in a raggedy old stable in a podunk town, unto us a child is born. Unto us a son is given. So unexpected. And so under attack. He will be so under attack that Herod, will say to kill every son under 2 years old. Satan again trying to wipe out the offspring in a murderous rage. That's the kind of war that's going to be waged against his son. It's going to be fierce. It's going to be vicious. And it's going to culminate on a hill called Golgotha. A hill that is named of all names, the place of the skull. And there the serpent crusher, the ultimate skull crusher, is going to be bruised. No skull crushing yet. There on the cross, the Son will take his harshest wounds. And the Bible tells us that the wounds that he takes are actually for us. They're our wounds. Wounded for our transgressions. Crushed for our iniquities. On the cross, the Son will be bruised, and he's going to stop. He's on the cross, he's going to stomp, and he's going to die. And he's going to be buried, and then on the first day, stomp. On the second day, stomp. On the third day, boom, boom. Death will be defeated. The serpent's power will be smashed. This is what Jesus has done. The Apostle John tells us that the reason Jesus came into the world is to destroy the works of the devil. And that's what he's done. Jesus has come to overcome him. Jesus has destroyed the works of the devil, and he will destroy him forever on the last day, when he throws Satan into the lake of fire, Revelation 21. That's a future day yet to come. And until then, for still our ancient foe does seek to work us woe. His craft and power are great, and armed with cruel hate on earth, he is not his equal. Satan's a bad dude. But do we, in our own strength, confide, our striving will be losing. We're not the right man on our side, the man of God's own choosing. Dost ask who that may be? Christ Jesus, it is he. Lord of hosts is his name, from age to age the same. He must win the battle, and he will. Jesus is going to come back. Jesus is going to finish this thing, because God will always do what he says. That's what brings us to the table. This table is where we proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. So if the band wants to come, the pastors want to come, and deacons to prepare the table. This is where, at this table, we remember what Jesus has done, and we look forward to what Jesus is going to do when he comes back to finish this. And as we're remembering back and as we're looking forward, we remember that this is for us. Jesus did this for us. Jesus died for you. Jesus was raised from the dead for you. Jesus conquered Satan for you. And Jesus is coming back for you. And so I want to invite you, if you trust in Jesus, if you want to say that, if you say that this morning, then I want you to come and remember what he's done at this table. We'll serve the bread first. We got gluten-free. Raise your hand if you want that. His body is the true bread. Let us serve you.